wicked person gets divine providence, but it is, you know, of a form designed to correct them or something along that line. In other words, we're kind of, I'm trying to make a distinction between the scale of righteous to wicked versus the scale of no intellect to much intellect. Because I don't think those are identical.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Right, but we do have the main categories of that. In terms of providence, it is something which can relate, will relate to the higher level person and could be down to the point where it's reduced based on the person's perfection until you have certain people that are completely not under God's providence. And they're just like animals. And they're just left exposed to what might befall them. Like Maimonides says on page 290. And then there's other considerations as well. Even when, again, like your question, just to review, that where it talks about how certain people may, you know, the ship may sink, but the fact that the people went into the ship is God's will. That would be, again, that would have to be tempered by the following chapter, where he says, now having shown all this, now let me just show you one more condition, that it all depends on your perfection. Certain people may not have the providence at all. And then, but again, we're all talking about in terms of perfection and providence for the good of a person. That's one category. Again, we're just scratching the surface here, so it's very hard to make any type of conclusive, you know, rules that are going to work across the board yet. Right now, we're just, you know, gathering information right now. But go ahead.
So when you talk about the intellect, do you mean the development of one's faculties, or are you talking about a baseline?
We're not talking about the perfection, meaning I should use the word perfection, because that's what Maimonides says. He says that divine providence is proportional to the endowment of intellect, as has been mentioned above. It's not the same for all men. The greater human perfection, see, now he switches off to perfection. So that means a person's intellectual capacity will contribute, and he can increase that, of course. I mean, a person, everybody's given a certain amount. Man, you know, you get Einstein, you get people like us. So then you have grades in between. You have people like, you know, Moses and Maimonides. So that's God's will, how a person's formed. But then he could use that, and he could follow what his mind tells him, and then that's the perfection. That's where he's earning merit for himself. And then as much as he's increasing that perfection and following his intelligence and increasing his knowledge and coming, you know, each day growing in his knowledge of what's truth and God and reality, so God's providence will relate to him more and more.
Well, no, yeah.
I couldn't hear you.
Who was that? Right.
Somebody has to put on the mute. I'm getting background conversations.
Rabbi, you just brought up an interesting point with the reference to Einstein. So, if I'm guessing, and I could be wrong here, that if we compared Einstein to Moses, that from a nuclear, an astronomical physics standpoint, and high-level mathematics standpoint, that Einstein probably had superior knowledge, but that in terms of areas sort of related to God and understanding God and how he works in the world and so forth, that Moses would be at the higher level.
Right.
So when we talk about intellect, I would presume that we are talking about intellect that is aimed toward an understanding of the Creator.
Well, intellect would mean the capacity. If a person has a greater intellect, I mean, we're talking about the capacity. If we talk about perfection, we're talking about harnessing that, you know, the faculties that each one of us have to fulfill our obligation. That would be perfection, where we're actually harnessing our faculties to live the correct life. Intellect just means just a reference to a certain capacity, which is, of course, you know, different degrees.
Okay.
All right. Now, I think it's important, since we're tackling this area, And there are a number of just observations I just jotted down, so I just want to share them with you. You know, I'm sure each one can be expanded upon, of course. But number one, we have a statement in the Torah. And since, again, we're basing everything on what we receive prophetically, and all is based on Sinai, and that means that all the, you know, the five books of Moses and the prophets and the writings are all God's words. So we're taking this, and this is why we're valuing them, and that's why we're saying there's so much study to them. But we have statements, for example, that this is in the Torah, that God will not kill fathers on account of their sons' sins, and God will not kill the sons on account of their fathers' sins. Each man in his own sin will God kill. Okay, so here we have an example of justice. And there's numerous examples. I mean, everything from the fact of how God created the universe in a way where everything is there for the species, and down to man, and man has there are foods that are made that work perfectly with man's digestive system, and many of them are very, very tasty. They just need even the enjoyment. And God gives man all the tools that he needs. He has the ability to move. He can be mobile. So he can approach things that are good for him and flee from things that are negative. He has intelligence. He knows how to make clothing and shelter. So God didn't just create man, but he gave him everything necessary. And that's an act of justice as well. And if we look through all the stories where God tried to dissuade Cain from killing his brother, and God warned the people and gave him 120 years, as Noah was building the ark to warn them that they should repent from their ways. So you have numerous cases throughout history that the God is working with justice. Additionally, we know that, we said this before, that anything which exists, it exists because God created it. So God has knowledge of everything. So there's nothing that he is ignorant of, no thought, no action of any human being. So we have to, you know, understand this as well, that when we're talking about that God is just, at the same time, we see that, like King Solomon says here, in verse 17 we read, I think last week or before, and I've seen all the, this is 8:17 in Kohelis. I've seen all the works of God. Man is not able to find it and to figure that out and to come to a complete understanding of all the actions that are performed under the sun. And on account of man, for if man would search out, he wouldn't find all the answers. And also, if a wise man would try to think into it, he wouldn't be able to understand it. So you see at the outset of this very discussion, King Solomon says that this is something which is beyond man's grasp. And this has to be, because man is not God. So it's important. And I think this is one of the biggest problems that people have when they face this area, is they feel that, you know, I can hear the answer. Tell it to me and I'll tell you if it makes sense or not. Well, there's many things that we are not going to know just because we are mortal. And, you know, our minds are quite feeble compared to God's knowledge. So we have to go into any area understanding that if we come away with a single idea, then we've had success. Not how other people want to say that, oh, you have to understand every single case and explain every case. Otherwise, forget it. That's a heretical view, where people, if there's one thing they can't explain, but 99 million things they did explain, they'll still have this chip on their shoulder, and they'll still have this type of a stance. Well, they're just looking for an out, because that was another verse. Another verse in here where King Solomon talked about that. All right, but you see that he says in this, you know, 8:17, that this is something which you can't find out practically looking through all the cases and studying it. He talked about how I didn't give my eyes sleep, right? In the previous verse, in 16 he said that. He didn't sleep and he was still studying it and he just couldn't figure it out. He says, we have another case also in the Torah where God says to Abraham, So when he was about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, so what did God say? He didn't say it to Abraham, but he said a narrative, you know, to teach the Torah reader. God said, am I going to keep hidden from Abraham what I plan to do? And Abraham is going to be a great and mighty nation. He's going to command his household after him to perform righteousness and justice in order that I could bring upon Abraham the promises that I swore to him. Then he starts to talk to Abraham, but that's a narrative. And God says in the narrative, will I keep hidden from Abraham what I plan to do? Meaning to say that this area of justice about destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, there's only so much that Abraham can derive by looking at the world and studying it and seeing how God operates. He could see that there's something called equality because all men have the same faculties. So he sees that this is God's will. There should be many people. And if many people should exist, that means there has to be a way that we ensure a certain level of equality. But there's also parts that are going to stay hidden. That's what God said. Well, I keep hidden from Abraham. And that was because that was the whole topic about God introducing Abraham. Because he said to, God said in the narrative, well, I keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do. And the reason why God's saying this is why, well, I really shouldn't keep it hidden, because Abraham is going to be a great mighty nation. He's going to command his household after him about God's justice. So therefore, it behooves my wishes for mankind to have greater knowledge that I impart to Abraham greater knowledge. So what was the greater knowledge? Abraham already knew that the wicked will be punished and the righteous will be saved. That's what he said to God. The shofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat, the judge of the whole earth will not do justice? No, of course not. That was not even a question. And you know that wasn't a question, because the only question he asks is that will you save all the cities on account of 50 righteous? And God only responds to that. Because when Abraham said that the judge of the whole world won't do justice, that was a rhetorical statement. He wasn't asking for a response. But what God imparted to Abraham was that he'll even save the wicked on account of the possibility that they can be turned to good by the righteous, if there's a certain quantity of righteous. So that Abraham didn't know yet. So this is what that whole conversation was about. So I'm just giving you cases where here you see, number one, numerous examples of God being just in his creation, in his principles in the Torah, that he's never going to kill one person because of what somebody else did. That wouldn't be just. And he gives a person a mouth, and he gives them digestion, and he gives the food that's able to satisfy all that. At the same time, there are areas that are hidden. So we have to have that knowledge going in, but you know, still look as far as we can, and but just understand that if we don't find an answer to something, we don't throw it out. Like, for example, that's what King Solomon did. Even after all these 16 verses about justice and how come the wicked are having it great and the righteous are not having it so great, still King Solomon says in 9:13, this also I see, despite everything I've just said, this also I see, that I've seen wisdom, that it is greater to me than anything. So you see that he comes back and he says, despite all these things, and we may have cases that come up, that does not mitigate the real position that wisdom has in the world. And he gives examples how you can have a person who's a city is being taken over, and then there's one wise man, and he counsels the people, and the city is saved from the enemy because he works out something, some political maneuver, whatever it is. And then he says right after that, the same verse, but people don't forget the wise man. I mean, they don't remember the wise man. He's forgotten. So he plays back and forth and shows you, but that shouldn't be a concern. That's, again, the concern of people. And that's what he does throughout here. He's vocalizing the foolish notions that people have. And that's what Ibn Ezra says, as a matter of fact. He says, He says in 9:4, he says, whoever is attached to life, he has some hope. Because it's better to be a live dog than to be a dead lion. You see? But this over here, Ibn Ezra says on the spot, this is the thoughts of the sons of man, that they say, whoever is attached to life, he's the one that has hope. Meaning, he's trying to show you that all these opinions are all based on the fact that people are isolated, they're assessing the value of the the wise and the righteous people and the wicked people, they're assessing it based on what they see happening on earth, and that's the end. They don't go further. And that's the mistake. And I'll show it to you. King David also says the same thing in Psalm 73. We'll read that in a second, too. Somebody had a question?
So just to clarify, you're saying that 9:4 is not what King Solomon holds, but he's saying that's what people say.
Exactly. That's exactly what Ebenezer says. I'll read it again. He says, these are the thoughts of man, that they say that whoever is attached to life, he's got hope. Okay, he says it also again. He says, Right, he says that, for example, he goes on from there in 9:5. Because the living know that they're going to die, but the dead, they don't know anything. And there's no reward to them anymore, and their whole memory is lost. This too, Ibn Ezra, I'll show you. He says this is just the expression of foolish people. Also, he goes into 9:6 and his their love and their hate and all their jealousy. It's all been lost. And they have no portion anymore in the world in anything that is done under the sun. You see, it's a continuation of the foolish opinion of people. And they say further, go eat with gladness your bread and drink with a good heart your wine. Because God knows, what does it say there? Let me read this to you. This is a good one. He says again, go and eat. Ibn Ezra says again, these are the words of the heart of man. And this is all foolishness. And he says, another matter, he says, that the dead have no portion in the world. So when you're alive, go eat and drink in happiness, and have your bread, and drink your wine, and a good heart. Because these are the things which God wants. So when it says at the end of verse 7, because God already wanted these things, that's the position of people. Eat, drink, and be merry. That's not King Solomon. And Ibn Ezra says it openly. He says further on the commentary on 8. Where he says the proper explanation of these verses, that there are before this and after this, they're all joined together, all connected, these verses. And these are all the words of the hearts of man. A third time, Ibn Ezra makes a point to tell you this. These are all the words of the heart that inside man's heart, as if man's speaking with his soul. So King Solomon just writes this down, but to vocalize the thoughts of man. Okay. And he goes on. He says even in 10, he says, everything which you find your hand to do with your strength, do. Because there's no more further action or considerations or knowledge or wisdom in the grave that you're going to. Okay. So you see, it's essential that we have the commentary and we understand. But we said a long time ago, many times we said, that he vocalizes the opinion of people in order to bring it out to the foreground. Now they can agree that they feel that way, but then he will address it. Okay. Now, we had finished, I think, to the end of 17, right? Of 8:17? Right, yeah, we did that. And we went into 9. If we could just put on the mute buttons, I'm still getting feedback. Thank you. Let's just see here if there's one more. Right. And again, just to stress it, that in 9:4, only those who are attached to life, they have any hope. Because it's better to be a living dog than to be a dead lion. See, life is what it is to them. This is the entire barometer And that's all people hold on to. And they push it away. They don't look at death. They don't realize it. They don't accept it as being a reality. And that's really going to be the ultimate state of, the, of this person's soul. So it's a tremendous shame, tremendous loss, because life really has a way of making a person feel that this is it and there's nothing else. And that's why they say these things, because the living know that they're going to die, but the dead don't know anything. That's 9-5. All the desires, their aspirations, their jealousy, their hatred, their loves, for they have no portion in the world and all the matters that take place under the sun. Under the sun again, earthly. Okay. Let me bring in at this point. Does everybody have mute buttons? Seems to be a feedback sounds on.
Maybe some kind of electrical interference, Rabbi.
Okay.
I've heard that before online.
Okay. Now in Psalms 73. So we see how King David is talking about the same phenomenon. And says, the wicked, they are in peace in the world. And he says that a person will say, for no reason have I been innocent, because I'm living a great, pure life, a righteous life, and the wicked have the same thing as me. So it seems to be as futile that I spent my time being innocent, pure, and righteous. And he says in 73:16, and I considered to know this matter, but it was very difficult until I came to the sanctuary, God's sanctuary, and then I understood their end. Whose end? The end of the wicked people. Then I understood that on slippery places had God placed them. And they would be, at the latter end, they'd be destroyed. So what does he say on this? So Rashi says, I saw what happened at the end of Sanherib. And then I understood that the end of the wicked, that it'll be destruction. And I said, all the good that came to them was a method of smoothing out from God. That God smoothed out their way, that they should find it easy to continue on their path, that they should not give heart to repent. And we see this also, that the word smooth out, that God says in the Torah too. Like Rabbi Chait said, that the prophets and writings have nothing new from the five books of Moses. The five books of Moses are the essence, and all the ideas are contained there. Prophets and writings are elaborations of the five books. And God talks about there, how he commands us in the Torah not to bow down to the sun and the moon, that he is the word chalak, that chalak can mean a portion out, that he portioned out to everybody. So the simple sense of the word is that the sun and the moon were just given to be utilitarian for man. He is light. He has light and he has whatever his needs for plant life, for human life, human existence. So he apportioned it out to everybody. He didn't make it as a thing to be deified. But the word chalak also means smooth. Smooth means it's very easy. So that means to say as follows, that when God, the Talmud, I think it's Sanhedrin, it talks about how one of the Greeks or the Romans were asking one of the Jewish, the rabbis, if God doesn't want you to bow to the sun and the moon, so why didn't he just destroy them? So the rabbi said, of course, obviously, God's not going to destroy the whole world just because some fools are bowing down to the sun and the moon. So he's going to take away the sun and the moon, and that'll destroy all life. But there's also another opinion, I'm not sure if it's there or some other place, where God makes it easy. I mean, he doesn't try to make it difficult or a person's doing the wrong thing, because then he's just going to stop his corrupt behavior because he's afraid of negativity that's going to happen. If a person, like we said last week, every time he eats something which is not kosher, he's shocked, so he'll stop eating the non-kosher, but not because he sees there's something wrong with the non-kosher food. So the same way, God does not step in and give you discomfort whenever you're doing something wrong. That's something which he leaves. It's smooth. He allows you to have an easy time doing that just as doing something else in order that there's nothing stacked. No side is, the cards are not stacked in any greater favor to do the good or to do the evil. Everything is, you can do either one you want just as easily. Each one is just as smooth to get into a sin as it is to get into doing a mitzvah. And he does that so this way, the reason why you actually choose mitzvah over a sin is because of your mind. See, if there would be some sort of a negativity associated with all negative acts, so then our mind would not be engaged. We'd just be afraid to do it because of discomfort or pain or fear. So that's what he's saying over here. So when King David said, but when I saw the end of Sennacherib, I see that he really was destroyed. So that's Rashi's explanation of how we finally understood that I see that the wicked are having it great, but King David's answer, he saw, because he says he finally went to the house of God. That means he consulted with the priests and the wise people of Israel. And they revealed this principle. And what's the principle? Now, Ibn Ezra steps in. He says, this principle is, and I understood their end. And that's what it says in the verse. And this is verse Psalms 73:17. And I understood their latter end. Because man is not brought to the world. I'm reading the Ibn Ezra. Man is not brought to the world, to this world, to luxuriate. That's a word, right? What's that?
Yes, Rabbi.
Okay, good. Thank you. So he didn't bring man into the world to luxuriate, to be involved in all these pleasures, or that he should become a king, or that he should become rich. Rather, that his end should be good. And this is the reward of the souls of the righteous. All right, so that's the end of the Ibn Ezra's commentary. So that's what it means when King David says, until I understood the end. Meaning, if I just concentrate on this world, and that's exactly what his son, King Solomon, is saying here in Qoheles. If a person will just look at the world, and it's better to be a living dog than a dead lion, meaning to say that life outweighs death on every single barometer. If that's your measurement, then you're right. You're going to have a very big question, because the wicked get away with everything. I mean, of course, that's not true. I should say the wicked are seen in certain cases to be getting away with everything. And you see certain cases where the righteous are having problems. So if that's how I'm going to measure it out, and the reason why it's a big question is because I know that God knows everything, and he could step in, but he's not. So it must mean there's a lack of justice. That's what a person might say, unless he goes further, as King David did, and thought about the latter end. So one latter end, like Rashi says, look at the end of the lives, and how they were destroyed by Hitler and Sennacherib and Caesar. And so you have many cases where people lived, they were central figures. They had everything, wealth, fame, anything they wanted. But look at the latter end. If it doesn't last, what good is it? That's one thing. That's even within the earthly bounds. But King David says, I think more, according to Ibn Ezra, I think it's a better answer. And that is, well, what's the ultimate state of man? So don't look at what happens on earth. And again, like Maimonides says, that the wisdom of God and how he meets out justice, he says that it may be by chance that a ship goes down with all of her contents, as in the above mentioned instance. This is in the guide, page 287, the Friedlander. Or maybe by chance that the roof of a house falls upon those within. But it is not due to chance, according to our view, that in the one instance the men went into the ship or remained in the house in the other instance. It is due to the will of God and is in accordance with the justice of his judgments, the method of which our mind is incapable of understanding. All right, so it's clear. And in this case here, of course, what his point is to distinguish between inanimate beings and animate beings that have souls. He's trying to show how God doesn't always relate to the ship. Sometimes he can. God created everything, so he can control everything he created. But in terms of providence, it relates to intelligent beings. So that's why it says it may be by chance that the ship goes down. Of course, that means that sometimes God will make the ship go down. But sometimes the ship can go down. But since that's set up in nature, God will direct the people, not interfering with their free will, but he'll direct certain people that deserve punishment to enter the ship and stay there. And then it ends up, nature takes its course, and those people who needed to be punished sank. You have another case like this in the Torah, where somebody killed purposefully and somebody killed accidentally, and there were no witnesses. So Rashi says God sets it up that both of these people end up going to a hotel one night. The one that killed purposefully sitting down on the floor, and he's sitting underneath the ladder, whatever he's doing. And the person who killed accidentally, he'll be motivated for some reason to start climbing up this ladder. Then God makes the ladder fall. The one who killed on purpose, and the guy who's on the ladder, falls down on the guy below him and kills him accidentally. But now there's witnesses. So the person who killed purposefully got killed. He got his just rewards. And the person who killed accidentally, God reenacted another case where, again, he was not the same lack of concern for human life. He expressed again. And he went up on this ladder, knowing there's somebody underneath it. The ladder broke. He fell down. And now the witnesses, now he gets his just reward and he has to go to exile. He has to go to the cities of refuge. So God can set it up. There's no lack. And again, we have to temper this with the fact that it's only in cases where God's providence extends to those people. This is not going to happen in the case where people are completely not due to, you know, to be under God's providence, as Maimonides says.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Does Maimonides equate divine providence to be equivalent to divine justice? That those are one and the same thing?
Yes. It has to be. We don't separate God's attributes. It's different to us, but in fact, anything that God does has to be just.
So, that seems to put us in a conundrum, because let's say the person that was guilty of the crime but hadn't been punished, you know, God sets up the situation so that he is punished, so divine providence is intervening. Then, if we follow Maimonides' definition, what we would have to say is, if that wicked person was a person of intellect, yes, God would intervene and would punish him, but if he was just a complete, had no intellectual development at all, but still had killed somebody, then God wouldn't intervene because of his lack of intellect. Do you see the conundrum I'm in?
Yeah, but the mistake I believe you're making is that you're separating perfection from intellect. See, if you have a person who's wicked, he's to be the one that's not under providence. I don't care that he has an intellect. The intellect is the first step that can lead you to having perfection. But if your intellect leads you to wickedness, you're not under providence.
But then if I'm not under providence, how does God intervene, like in the example you just discussed, so that the wicked person gets their just desert?
Because a person killed one person, I don't know how God assesses the levels of man, when he deserves providence, when he doesn't. I can't answer that. There's so much, I mean, in terms of considerations. And if, let's say, a person lives a righteous life his whole life, and then one, he's jealous of his wife, she was with somebody, and he was in a frenzy, and he killed the guy. But his entire life, he lived righteous, intelligence, and everything. So we judge that person the same way as a person who's like a mafioso, who kills and then goes, sits down, and has a sandwich. And he does the same thing the next day at 2 o'clock. And he just does it as part of his job. So even killing is something which, I remember Rabbi Chaim was saying, not regarding killing, but God judges a person less harshly when his infraction was, when he was overcome by a desire, as opposed to like a premeditated calm type of a thing.
Okay. Can I ask a related question?
Yeah.
So, in the earlier part of Maimonides, when he talks about the leaf falling and so forth, he says, I don't believe that it's the interference of divine providence, certain leaf drops, or a certain spider catches a certain fly. creation is, according to my opinion, entirely due to chance. Now, if none of those species has free will, then and God created the world and all the things in it that have one cause which causes another cause which causes another cause which causes another cause to an extraordinarily complex ability that we can't grasp. Wouldn't God know, or essentially when he set it up, wouldn't the setting up of it have determined that that particular gnat fly will go into that particular web and that particular spider will get it, assuming that man's free will didn't somehow intrude on the system?
Yes, you're right. When God set up the system and created laws of nature, because of exactly where and when and all these different things and temperatures, these things have to unfold that way. It's all based on cause and effect. That does not mean, however, that he desired this leaf to fall first over that one. This is what happened based on the laws of nature. It's different. There's two things here. One thing is, did God cause it? Did his laws that he put into effect have that we would have to unfold this way? Yes. But that's not to say that God wills it, that he wanted it, that this leaf should fall first or this leaf should fall second. He wanted the systems to be in place, that there should be such a thing as the leaves falling from trees and wind causing leaves to drift a certain distance and so on and so forth and all the other things. But that does not mean that he wants there to be, you know, a trillion raindrops falling today as opposed to a trillion and one.
I have trouble grasping the difference, because if he through his wisdom set it all into motion, then it would seem that he intended it to be the way that it is.
Yeah, but if we think about it, it doesn't appeal to the mind as being such a consideration that really should matter at all in any way whatsoever. I know that they have these things about, you know, a butterfly effect. So if there's some butterfly in Angora or wherever it is and it moves its wings, that's going to affect some trickle-down domino effect in another part of the world, and it's going to be a volcano. I don't buy that. And I don't think any, there's other more overwhelming causes that cause a volcano than the movement of a butterfly's wings. And just in terms of, again, we're talking about God here, so we're going to use our terminology in terms of, yes, he is the cause. That I think we have a clear understanding that everything is in existence because he put it into motion, except for man's choices. But everything else? Right. But you see, like Rambam is saying, Maimonides is saying, it appeals to the mind what he's saying. It doesn't matter if this bug catches, you know, this fish catches that worm as opposed to another one. What matters is that the species continues. And that's why he talks about that God's providence relates to the species, not to the individual members.
Yeah, I guess this starts to relate to trying to understand the question of, okay, you know, X thousands of people died in a tsunami, and if you look at each of those people individually, you know, was not as a species, but just as individuals, was there divine providence or divine effect in that fact, or is somehow... Well, I suppose you could make the argument that the reason that that person happens to be there is because of some kind of intervention of human free will, where they decided to be on the beach that day or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, God...
Wrap my arms around it.
God has no shortage of abilities to do what he wants. When the Twin Towers fell, so, you know, God could make sure somebody got there a little bit late, like a friend of mine told me. And he came out of the train station at 9:30 after the second plane already impacted, and he saw people running, and it's lucky he got there late. Right? And there's many ways that God can control who's going to be spared and who's not, who deserves to have intervention, who not. The tsunami, like Rabbi Chase said years ago when it happened, so it had to happen because you have the tectonic plates on the sea floor, and you have tremendous forces, and when they shift, it's such a tremendous shift. And the waters moved so suddenly and so abundantly that you have to have the surface of the water being affected, which causes a giant wave. Now, who's going to step in? You know, I mean, who is God going to step in for to save? That's his decision. And to say when and where, what was miraculous, what was not, without any reason to, we don't say that. I mean, it's true there's catastrophes, but there's been catastrophes throughout time. And, you know, we were reading yesterday the Sforno, the last Sforno on the Parsha, on Tazria. And he talks about, and part of it was edited out. And he's talking about how God's providence, this exact position, just like Maimonides, there's laws of nature. The Sforno says the exact same thing, so you should take a look. It's laws of nature that work. And he says that, you know, most people are just like under chance. And he talks about how, he makes this another statement. He says that all the other nations, except for the Jews, and most of the Jewish people are misled. So some editor took it out. It's not in the in many of the Torahs that we have, because they didn't want it to reprint the fact that Sforno, a great, you know, leader in Jewish thought, was saying that most of the Jewish nation is misled. But he was saying that this is true, because the bottom line is, what is the pursuit of most people? Are they spending the amount of time necessary, or time at all during the week in wisdom and thought and, you know, really trying to understand the Torah, or is it the pursuit for wealth and money and so on? So it's even back in Sforno's time. My friend had asked me, he said his daughter asked him a question that, because everybody in the world, you know, his daughter goes to school, or everybody's being taught the opposite. Now, every single thing which happens, God wants it to happen right now, and also they don't really think clearly. They take metaphors literally in the Talmud, that Og was a giant, and he lifted up Mount Sinai over the Jews' head, and, you know, they don't even think that, you know, how come this event is not written in the Torah if it was a real literal event? But they're being trained. Foolish people have been trained foolishly from their youth. They're now teachers today. And they're teaching children today. Luckily, my friend is intelligent, and he's raising his daughters properly. And he wanted to know what a good answer would be. Why is it there's only so few people that are following a rationalist view? And she was referring to her father, you know, you, Dad, you're following a rationalist view, but everybody else in my school, everybody else I see in the world, they all believe in this metaphor. You know, they take all these metaphors literally. They believe in, you know, nonsensical things. And mystical things in Judaism. These are religious Jews. So he wanted to have a good answer. So he had the answer. He was just, you know, passing it by us. And the answer was basically God said during the time of Noah that the inclination of man is evil from youth. I mean, the instincts and the emotions have a 13-year head start on a human being. The mind doesn't develop until the point of 12 or 13. That's why we're not commanded in the mitzvos until that age. So since people are so entrenched in emotion and in foolishness and in fantasy for so many years at the start of their lives, most people just cannot extricate themselves from it. They don't try to. They want to just keep satisfying what feels good. Whatever sounds good, they repeat. And that even people that become teachers, they think they're doing good. They're just repeating over foolish things that nobody ever abandoned. They never stop to think about. So the world is still that way. All right. Any other questions or comments? I think we're running out of time.
Rabbi, may I briefly comment on the leaf stealing?
Good.
As I'm thinking about the question, some leaves are planted from trees that free will agents, that is man, plant. So we would think that God did not set those particular trees in motion if we are, you know, free will agents. So then we would have a system where God is declaring some leaves to fall and some leaves just according to the system. So it makes more sense to me to accept that God set up a general system rather than the individual falling of the leaves.
Yeah, and I'll give you support for that, too. The point is that, I mean, keep in mind also, this natural law that comes into play even after a human being plants a tree. So even there, a person could argue, well, maybe the man planted the tree, but well, then you'll say, well, the location of the tree and that will affect things, but it's just, it's beyond the, you know, what reason tells us that it matters at all. That should it matter also what color red the leaf turned before it fell off the tree? Maybe it should have been a darker red, or the angle that the leaf is falling. I mean, all these things are just, is irrelevant. But if you take a look at Avos, Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Father, of the Fathers, so there in chapter 5, the Mishnah, the sixth Mishnah, so Maimonides' comments, where it talks about there were 10 things that God created on, what's the word for that first Friday? The primordial? Is that the right word? I'm not sure.
I think it's primordial.
Yeah, primordial. So the primordial Friday, that first Friday, right before sunset, right before God finished creation, he created 10 miracles. So what do we create 10 miracles? What were the miracles? The mouth of the donkey that spoke thousands of years later by Bilam. The rock that gave forth water in the desert by the time of Moses. And a number of other things. So what do we mean he created the miracles then? They didn't happen until thousands of years later. So what does it mean he created them then, right before sunset on that first Friday? It means to say that he planted into the physical properties that these miracles would eventually take place. But why not just perform the miracle at the time that it was needed? What's the point of saying that God made these miracles then? So it shows you, number one, that God doesn't work in time. God created time, like Maimonides says. Time is a creation. So God doesn't have a now and a later, a before and an after, a tomorrow and a yesterday. So that means that when he created the universe, however he did it, it naturally had properties in it that would unfold at the precise moment needed for the miracle to take place. And Maimonides comes in and he says, but it wasn't only these 10. For example, when God caused the miracle of the sun standing still when Joshua was waging war, and he prayed to God that the sun should stand still so they could still have more light to finish the war, that was built in on the second day when God created the sun, or the third day, whenever the sun was created. And the miracle of the sea splitting when the Jews left Egypt, that was built into the day that God created water. He built it into the fabric of water that there should be a certain property that should unfold at a certain time. So why does God say that these 10 miracles alone he made at sunset? And meaning to say that these were certain aberrations that couldn't be built into the property when it came to existence. Meaning, let's say, for example, the rock that gave forth water in the desert. So a rock, by definition, is a dry, arid, solid substance. It's the antithesis of something where water can flow from or originate from or even contain because it's dry, and water is the opposite. So when God created rock in the beginning, on the first day, God created heavens and earth. So when he first created what rock is, whatever those minerals are, in order that you have a solid earth that people can walk on and build things on, rock had to come into existence as that property of a dry, hard substance. If he brought it into existence as something with water inside of it, then the entire earth wouldn't be functioning. You couldn't have living beings, you know, roaming it and building on it. So therefore, in terms of how it came into existence, it had to have certain properties. Subsequent to its creation as a dry, hard, arid substance, then God could make a certain change in certain rocks. That's what it means at sunset. After everything was put into existence in the right design, the last moment, there were 10 more things that had to be done for the sake of mankind, because otherwise the Jews in the desert wouldn't have water, or the donkey speaking to Bilam, or the rainbow, whatever those 10 things were. But all those 10, I believe they're all an antithesis to the very substance they were put into. So those couldn't have been created at the moment of their creation. All right? But, for example, water splitting. So why was that something God could create on the day he made water? That seems to be an antithesis. No, because you have something called surface cohesion in water. If you look at a drop of water on the table, it piles up. It's like a hemisphere. So you see that water has some property of piling in a small amount. but the property is there. And if you read when God split the waters, it says that they piled up. They split and they were like piles. Kimonade. So that was something which could exist when God created the water. That's not an antithesis. It's not antithetical to the very properties of water to have that type of a property of surface cohesion in a pile. So maybe somehow God accentuated that existing property. So there he can create it when he created water on the second day. Whatever day, I'm not, don't hold me to which day it is. So you look, you'll see the verses, which day he created, or which days he separated it. But in terms of, for example, a rock giving forth water, that could not be when he created rock on the first day, when he created heavens and earth, for the reasons that we stated. But what you learn from this is that everything is now put into motion, and then that's it. He creates everything, and he's done with the creation. Then it's taking its own course, which is in compliance with Maimonides' words over here, that the leaf falls naturally. I mean, if God made miracles built into the fabric of creation, and now it's sort of like a time clock. He doesn't have to do anything any further. He built creation in the way where certain miracles are going to be, they will unfold, you could say naturally, so to speak, at a certain moment when they're needed. So if he could do that by miracles, why can't he do that by natural law too?
So, Rabbi, here's an additional idea. Go back to the example you gave of tectonic plates shifting, causing the tsunami. It would seem that if God created the universe and everything that came in it, and so you go back to all the go back from one cause to the next, to the next, to the next, and go backwards, you get back to the Creator, which means as long as man, who has free will, hasn't done anything to influence the system, and I'm going to, just for the sake of the argument, suggest that in terms of tectonic plates shifting, man hasn't done anything that would have affected that, then it would seem that that event was the result of causes that God laid out from the beginning. But to the degree that man intervenes, so let's say man comes along and plants a tree over here, the tree grows up and eventually falls on a house, that was a result of man intervening in the system, and unless there were divine providence, you know, affecting those people, that tree is going to hit their house and whoever happens to be in it. Does that seem reasonable?
Well, are you going back to saying that God caused that tsunami? That was your issue before, that if God did it, man didn't interfere at all. That means it has to be traced back to only one cause, that being God. So you're now saying God causing it means God willed it too. And I'm trying to show you that those are two separate things. Just because you could trace back events to God, it doesn't mean that he wanted this. It means it didn't matter. These events had to take place because of how the world. Why can't you just say that the tectonic plates had to shift because that's how Earth will survive for the next, 10,000 years? Not because these people had to get hit. How do you know which? And how do you even know that those plates shifting was a real? Maybe some other plates could have shifted. Whatever it was, there were forces. Just like we're saying, God built into the 6 days of creation certain miracles. During the day when he made the actual substance of water, he built into the splitting. Certain days he couldn't build it in, so he built it into the last moment. But then that's it. Now it's built in, and now it'll happen at a certain time for those needs. So when he created natural law too, they're going to unfold on their own. Like Maimonides says, it doesn't matter when the leaf falls incidentally, or if a certain, if a certain fish eats a certain worm. It's not that God wants that worm to die over another. What did that worm do? That he's going to die now, and the other one gets to live. It doesn't make sense to say that there's a need now for that worm to die, as opposed to the other worm to die.
It sounds like you're making a distinction between God causing something and God willing something.
Yes, exactly.
And I guess I'm having trouble seeing how those could possibly be different.
Right.
Because if God caused something, that meant that he made a decision, or our terminology, that should happen.
Isn't there a difference between wanting it to happen or being irrelevant if it happens? I can do something right now because I can hit this domino right now and it's going to unfold all those other dominoes, da, 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 and there's one piece of lint a mile away underneath the last domino that's going to get blown by the current of air of that last domino falling, and the lint's going to move about a half an inch. Now, I could want that to happen, or I could just, it happened, yeah, it doesn't matter at all. In this scheme of God's will for the world, there are going to be things like that, the way the natural world is structured. Like Rabbi Chase said, it could be that because God created water and temperature, it had to be, not because God desired it to be, but it had to be. Every snowflake will have six corners. It's not that that's a design by nature. Other things are more important, that there's moisture and there's temperature change. But due to that, and due to how crystalline structures work, this is just a natural result, like Rabbi Chaim explained. So certain things are the will of God, that there should be water and all. Certain things are not. So that lint blowing, the fact that snowflakes have six corners to them, or the no two are alike, that could just be an offshoot of which is more primary.
Yes, but I'd argue that that's pure conjecture, because let me go back to the dominoes that you set up, okay? You got the dominoes set up, somebody hits it, and then the lint moves at the end. If we're going to say, well, God set up like the first domino, but then the rest of them, just kind of came about, it seems like that is putting a limit on what God's ability to understand infinite causes and effects is.
Why is that? He knows it. There's no inability in terms of his knowledge or his ability to do what he wants. But there are certain things. There are certain things that are necessary, so it's what he wills. Certain things are irrelevant. Why can't there be irrelevant results in the natural order? Why must there be meaning behind every single movement, every single event?
All I'm saying is, when we get down to the lint, okay, if we say, well, that's irrelevant, so then back yourself up the chain there from the lint to the wind to the last domino to the second to the last domino all the way back and say, well, at what point did it become relevant to God?
Man, it never was. That lint was never relevant. What was relevant was that there should be something called cause and effect. That's relevant to God.
Was the last domino relevant? I mean,
I don't know how we're going to quantify that. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to go into, God's mind and say.
That's the problem I'm having. It seems like we're drawing a line somewhere in God's mind saying, this part's relevant and this part isn't. And all I'm saying is that if the lint moves, that God is the ultimate cause of the lint moving.
But
the way he set things up. Maybe we're saying exactly the same thing in different words.
Well, you're saying that he wants it. I'm saying it doesn't matter. I don't think we're saying the same thing.
I can't even ascribe the term want. All I'm saying is that there's no other cause for that lint moving ultimately except God.
Well, the fish catching worm A as opposed to worm B. So Maimonides says it's not by God's will, it's by chance. That means he accepted the idea that will does not extend all the way down the line. I don't know where to say where it stops, where it starts. I can't do that. There's just too many factors going in there. I don't think any human being has that ability. So we'd have to think we'd have to think into his opinion. He's also quoting Aristotle over there that had the same position on that, due to chance, that what would cause him to say that? Why can't you say that God's willing every single thing? All right, so that's the question to be entertained then. What do we gain by saying that God is not willing this fish to catch that worm? Why can't I say he is willing this fish to catch that worm? But maybe the problem is that by saying that, it sounds like God's concerned about things which are really irrelevant in terms of his whole purpose in creation. That there are things that are irrelevant. That's just how the physical world has to operate. It doesn't matter in a person's life if he has 1,000 freckles on his body or 1,001 freckles on his body. It's what extra freckle is completely irrelevant. There are causes why it happened because of his biology and his diet and his genetic structure. There's definitely causes, but it's not something which God will that this extra freckle should be there.
And I guess my point is, when Maimonides says chance, I have an issue with that, because it seems like if you take any event and you go backwards in the series of causes, you either have to get to a place where free will happened and there was some intervention, we can't explain free will, or there's a cause chain that goes clear back to the Creator. And I don't know that we can say what's relevant and what's not to his, you know.
Well, I'm all right, so that's a point of a dispute that we have then.
Okay.
We started out with an earthquake and then we went back to fish and worms, and it seems like the fish and worm would be easy to say was irrelevant, but the earthquake where thousands of lives were at stake seems not to be the same category.
Well, you see, my mind is just talking about it. Certain people that are completely oblivious to perfection and intelligence, they're just like animals. And they're left exposed to whatever might happen. That's no less, because you know, if a person is not filling his role, so his existence is really irrelevant. He says, that of course goes against what the masses want to say, that every single life is precious. Yeah, if you use it properly. But I would not say wicked people are precious, and I wouldn't say that a person who's living an idolatrous Christian life, that there's anything precious about that, because they're completely wrong about the Creator, and the whole purpose they exist is to comprehend the Creator. And a rock is closer to the truth than people like that, because at least a rock is functioning as it should. But a person who thinks that somebody can die for sins, or that you can pray to man, and the most harmful opinions, and they spread this to others, and they create societies where people are just trapped into this very, magnetic type of philosophy. So they're doing the worst harm.
I think I'm going to have to contemplate that for some time.
Yep. I can understand that. But you see, my mind, he says that. I'm just looking for where he says that. He says, divine influence, page 289 in the guide. Divine influence. Let me just read up a bit. In the same proportion as ignorant and disobedient persons are deficient in that divine influence, their condition is inferior and their rank equal to that of irrational beings, meaning animals and minerals and plants. And they are like unto the beasts. And he's quoting King David. This is Psalms 64:21. Excuse me. XL would be 40. I'm reading it wrong. XL, that's 40. IX9, 49:21. They're unto the beasts. For this reason, it was not only considered a light thing to slay these people, but it was even directly commanded for the benefit of mankind. And you see, it wasn't just the Gentiles, like a Moloch, that we were commanded to kill. If you had a city of Jews that the majority had worshipped idolatry, you destroy the entire city of Jews. That's a law in the Torah. That's one of the 613 commands. Not only a light thing to slay them, but directly commanded for the benefit of mankind. And God's the one who makes the decisions about what is morally correct and not. We don't try to appease people. That's a big problem with Israel and the Palestinians.
Rabbi, I know we're short on time, but the next statement after that,
yep,
is this belief that God provides for every individual human being in accordance with his merits is one of the fundamental principles on which the law is founded.
Right, and it could be certain people where they are like left up a chance. That's where if you turn the page, you have to keep reading again. Consider how the action of divine providence is described in reference to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and so on. And then he goes down halfway. He says, the following verse describes how providence protects good and pious men and abandons fools. Right? You see that? Providence abandons fools. Quote, he will keep the feet of the saints, and he will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be in silent in darkness. So you see, he says openly that providence abandons fools. It does not relate to him at all. Okay. So you have to read it together. You can't just take the one verse, which could be misleading on its own, but then read and see that it's true that he does say the belief that God provides for every individual human being in accordance with his merits is one of the fundamental principles. So when it's removed from somebody, that you could say is a way of saying God is providing in that case in accordance with his ignorance and his imperfection, that he doesn't deserve providence at all.
So then we just need to hold as an open question, I think, the question of how can that be, and simultaneously God steps in and punishes the wicked.
Right, we'll have to address that too. Hopefully we'll be able to see if we can get some insights into that.
Okay.
And like Ibn Ezra says, I'll end with this one quote. He says, on 9:3, this whole question about how the righteous suffer and the wicked have it great, there is nothing underneath the sun that is more difficult than this. Okay? That's Ibn Ezra, 9:3. And therefore man's heart is filled with evil and foolishness during their lives. Did you get it, Doug?
I was going to say, maybe there's some comfort that if what he's saying is this is the most difficult question, we've at least stumbled into it.
Yeah, again, we have to keep in mind, we're not going to answer everything. But we have to be clear on what we can answer. And you know, forge ahead. And, you know, and then, you know, after time, we can hopefully cull all of what we've discussed and seen so far and come away with some rules. But, you know, there always will be more to study. There'll all be more, you know, facets to this. And we have to realize there are rules, and then there will be cases we can't explain. That doesn't mean there's not an explanation. I mean, it may be beyond our ability to comprehend. Right? And both, you know, King David, King Solomon, Ibn Ezra, they're all saying the same thing. These things are too far for man to get the answers to everything. But that does not mean that we turn around and we deny the fact that wisdom is a great thing. And that's what King Solomon does in Qohelet. After he discusses this whole thing, he says, but wisdom still, in my mind, is the greatest thing. Yeah, I can't answer everything, but wisdom is definitely the way to go in terms of how you live your life. And God definitely is just, and I see all the cases. And if I have some questions in certain cases, I'll have questions. But you study the creation, you study how we made man, and the good that God bestowed, and all the acts of intervention to try to help out individuals and societies. You can't just throw that away because you have questions. What's true, you lie, you write down, write it down. That's the column of things that I know are true. Those are real. Okay, then I have questions. Question doesn't undo a truth. It's a question. All right, you have Rabbi Moskowitz today, I know.
We do. I suspect people will be on the phone in just a minute or two.
Yeah, okay, so let me go so you can get to that. And we'll pick up next week. We'll keep going ahead. And again, anything...
I appreciate it.
Yeah, any questions during the week, don't hesitate. Please, you know, call or email, whatever. There's no reason we... have to just wait a whole week to pursue different things that come up, all right?
All right. Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody. Good talking to you. Have a great week, everybody.